The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia, New Jersey. Welcome to Inside Medicine. We have another excellent program today. We are going to have two residents from Roman University, both outstanding doctors. And I would just like to open up with just a few comments. The first is a positivity. Crude oil is down 25% from its highs, so that makes it easier at the pump. And hopefully people will be going to the shore, but make sure that I get there first. Of note, believe one defines themselves by reinvention by Henry Collins. I like that. So every day is a different day, and let's keep on reinventing ourselves. Of note, 90% of the working age population is going to come from Africa and New Asia, essentially Asia except for China, South Korea, and Japan. India will generate close to 183 million more working age people by 2025 than Germany, France, and Canada combined. Where are the workers going to come from? So basically what we're saying is that we go to the Wall Street Journal, and they indicate that, quote, in the editorial today, children are priceless. The Brookings Institute is making a media splash with its estimate that it will now cost $300,000 to raise a child through high school. Seems a bit high to me. Even ignoring human affection and thinking in the most utilitarian terms, children are assets to the families who raise them, to the nation in which they are born, and to the world to which they will contribute across their lifetime. A real cause for concern is the declining U.S. birth rate that is falling below the replacement rate. Without immigration, the U.S. population would begin to shrink. There is nothing to cheer. Whatever children cost to raise, they are a priceless vote of confidence in the future, and I will say that about my grandchildren. Let me introduce my two guests today. We have Sultan Kawam, physician. He is presently doing a residency rotation at the Rowan School of Medicine. He is a graduate of Rutgers University. He is a Sigma Sigma Phi National Osteopathic Honor Society Award. He has an incredible experience. He's worked at the Center for Advanced Biotechnology and Medicine in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He has participated in the Mad Science of West New Jersey, which was assisting students who had struggled in school with science, and he helped them out. He's published, a fantastic guy. Our second lineup is an incredible female, Kelly Tichy. Dr. Tichy is currently an internal medicine resident with Inspira Health, but before that, her accomplishments include being a pre-graduate medical fellow at SpaceX and publishing a book chapter focusing on viral infections and breastfeeding. She has done volunteer medicine in Kenya, Guatemala, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, and was honored with an Excellence in Public Health Award from the United States Public Health Service in 2021. She currently serves as a medical director for Entepsi Kenya, a nonprofit that delivers primary and preventive health care to the Mount Kilimanjaro area of Kenya. A fantastic person, and we will hear from her quickly. Sultan, just like to welcome you to Inside Medicine.
Thank you for having me.
So let me just ask you, I have to tell everybody that basically you were an individual who was interested in orthopedics and switched, I think, to the tougher cardiology area, where you wanted to become eventually a guy who sits there with life or death in the cath unit. So it's always a pleasure to have a guy like you, a man with nerves of steel.
Absolutely. I appreciate it.
So what do you think about residency so far?
Right now, I'm loving every bit of it. I feel kind of reborn at this point. So far, I've been able to see kind of various experiences. So I've been under an inpatient cardiology rotation, something that I want to do. So I've been able to see the common bread and butter cardiology, including myocardial infarctions, acute coronary syndromes, arrhythmias like AFib and heart failures. I've been working on the general floors, being able to manage multiple pathologies, again, all organ systems. And most importantly, I got to rotate with you, learning the bread and butter endocrinology. And probably most importantly, kind of learning from you how to develop lifelong relationships with your patients.
Fantastic. I already put your grades in, though.
Nice.
So, Sultan, let me ask you this. Where do you think you're going? It seems to me that you were pretty strong that you were going towards being a cath guy, which is you need nerves of steel for. Where do you think you are, and where do you think you're going at this point?
Yes. The most important thing is everyone told me to keep an open mind, especially starting off residency. To be a great cardiologist or a great specialist in whatever field you want to go into, I think you need a fundamental understanding of each and every single organ system. That's because, especially in cardiology, you have an interrelationship with each organ system, including your cardiorenal, especially cardio and respiratory systems working intertwined together. So to be a great cardiologist, I think you need to understand kind of how everything interlays and everything works together. But specifically, as you mentioned, kind of being a cath guy, it gives me the opportunity to still perform procedures, which I do love, but I also get to combine my love of medicine and being able to kind of do all the above.
I think you're 100% right there. So let me just switch here to Kelly. So Dr. Kelly Tritchy is currently an internal medicine resident within Spear Health, but before that, her accomplishments include being a pre-graduate medical fellow at SpaceX. I can't believe what you're going to hear about space, and publishing a book chapter focusing on viral infections and breastfeeding. She has done volunteer medicine in Kenya, Guatemala, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, and was honored with an Excellence in Public Health Award from the United States Public Health Service in 2021. She currently serves as medical advisor for Entepse Kenya, a nonprofit that delivers primary and preventive health care in the Mount Kilimanjaro area of Kenya. In her spare time, she competes in rein cow horse competitions and grew up riding horses and working on ranches. She's certainly not the normal doctor we would come across. But Kelly, obviously, you've had a different experience in your training. Tell us one thing that impacted your training.
Yeah, so something that I don't really talk about at work because I don't really want it to alter people's perceptions of me or, you know, make it my narrative is that I live with ADHD. It runs in my family. My father was very ADHD, and that was kind of the 90s, you know, and things were different surrounding mental health and developmental disorders, and so I went most of my life remaining untreated. Back then, if you were doing well, you know, you couldn't have ADHD, and when I got to medical school, that became a very different conversation. It's something that's very poorly understood by a lot of people. Some people really don't think that ADHD is a thing because most ADHD people are functioning in society, but it's very real, and it changes a lot about how you think.
And obviously, people with ADHD can make magnificent gains and donate to society like you have. I think that I would never guess that you had ADHD. Follow up. What are the most frustrating misconceptions about ADHD?
Yeah. So the best way that I've had it explained to me kind of by my therapist is that people with ADHD, it's kind of like warm-blooded and cold-blooded animals. So most people think that we can't focus, but it's not that we can't focus, it's that we can't regulate that focus. So where a lizard can't regulate its internal temperature, it has to regulate it with its external environment, we're the same way with focus. So our brain is required to hook on to the thing around us that demands the most attention, and we just can't redirect that. it also really has a lot to do with executive functioning, which if people don't know what executive functioning is, it has a lot to do with making plans, deciding to do something, and breaking those plans down. And people think that because I can do more advanced things and things that most people see as difficult, they assume that I should be able to do easy things, and they get really frustrated with me when I can't do things that they perceive as easy, like being on time and not losing my keys. But those things are really difficult for my brain and take a lot more energy for me than a normal person, simply because that neurological circuit doesn't exist for me. So for example, like once I decide to do something, I have a lot of difficulty visualizing the final product of that task, which means that I have difficulty breaking it down backwards. And I get permanently stuck in this sort of planning and preparation phase, and I never get to initiate the task. In medical school, that's an Achilles heel, as I'm sure you know, self-studying is all, okay, where do I need to be and how do I need to get there? And I just can't do that on my own without assistance. So it changes the way you interact, and you don't want people to think that you're undisciplined or that it's a behavioral issue, and it can make you feel kind of bad about yourself sometimes if you don't have people around you that support you.
Well, all I can say is, Kelly, so what my interactions with you, I would never know that you had ADHD, and you're certainly, you're outspoken, you're environmentally attuned, and you do a lot of good for a lot of people, and you seem to see through some things that people won't tell you. So I'd say, in your case, ADHD is a plus. So some people
Thank
would
you.
Say ADHD is doom and gloom, but, I saw upsides, so tell me some upsides of having ADHD.
Yeah, so like you said, ADHD people, I think, tend to be pretty perceptive. A lot of the experts in the field, there's kind of this diction that maybe ADHD is a brain type that originated in hunter-gatherer times, and you're more of the hunter. You have to pay attention to your environment. It makes you good at thinking on your feet. You process information very quickly, almost real time as it's coming at you, and it helps you with creative thinking and problem solving. So I've learned to embrace what I call the importance of boredom. If I let my brain be bored, it runs and does wild things, and I think a lot of world-changing ideas have come from ADHD brains that have gotten bored. So I try to force myself to be bored once a day, and that helps me do a lot of new things and discover a lot of interesting activities.
Okay, so now we're going to switch to Sultan. He's a solid performer, cool, calm, and collected. So tell me, Sultan, do you have any interest in mental health, particularly depression? Can you give us some insight?
Yeah, no, of course. So I think it's important to kind of have people be aware of mental health, specifically depression. It's something that I experienced prior to my transition into this residency. So the reason why I think that this is something worth talking about is because there's a huge stigma around this, which causes issues in recognizing and providing treatment for it. Most of the times, because most people that are depressed aren't realizing that they have it themselves. So it's important for friends, families around them to recognize it, and most importantly, their providers, so that they can promptly recognize it and treat it appropriately. I think some important facts to know. So just in the U.S. alone, the risk of developing major depression is around 30%. I think what causes depression, it's still kind of largely unknown. There's a theory that there's a downregulation of neurotransmitters like serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. But there's also new theories that are involved in theories of neuroplasticity, which basically means that there's functional changes and structural changes in response to both a person's environment and experiences. So things you want to look out for, especially since it occurs mostly in patients that are in their 20s or 50s, and in women they're twice as likely to suffer from depression than men. Things you want to look out for, especially recent histories of having a divorce, if they've had prior history of depression, any recent stressors or traumas, or even a family history of depression in mother, father, brother, or sister. So things you want to look out for. These are included in the DSM-5. Usually patients will have like a depressed or irritable mood. If you've noticed that you've had loss of interest in things that you normally took joy in partaking, if you're noticing some type of change in your eating habits, whether you're not eating at all or you're eating too much, if you're noticing that you're sleeping a little too much, sleeping too little, or if you're in bed and you're noticing that you're having trouble falling asleep, kind of feeling anxious all the time or restless or chronically fatigued, or if you're thinking to yourself that you're feeling a little bit worthless. And a huge factor is problems concentrating. So a lot of times you're not doing as well in school or in work. You're noticing that your grades are declining. You're getting in trouble at work, things like that. So the reason we want to take care of this is basically, as I mentioned, if you stay untreated, usually you get a lot of issues. So things you can do, especially if you diagnose it, is there's something called psychotherapy. And there's been prior studies that showed that there's a huge success rate from 48% versus just 19% if patients don't do anything. Things you can do are like cognitive behavioral therapy, in which you can identify and modify like negative thoughts. You can also do a behavioral activation where you can schedule positive activities and increase positive interactions, or even something called interpersonal psychotherapy. Regardless of what you do, that has shown that any type of psychotherapy works. So it's just important that you kind of do something. Some helpful site that you can go into is betterhelp.com. There's something called HERS.com. And then also there's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration. And that number is 1-800-622-HELP. Those are something that can help patients or individuals kind of get started to hopefully overcome these issues.
So fantastic. I just want to point out that your podcast will go up in 2 hours, and some of the data that goes past, if somebody wants to review it, they can go in 2 hours after the show to www.wwdbam.com. You just look for, usually on the second line of the radio show, 860 AM, The Big Talker, it'll say Inside Medicine. Click on that, and then you'll be able to hit podcast. But the podcast will be up 2 hours post this visit, so if you're looking for numbers, et cetera, please check out the podcast. So obviously, again, you know, you're a guy who's an high-output player, cool, calm, and collected. I know you want to be a cardiologist, and my impression is you're going to be an invasive cardiologist, one of the guys who's got to have nerves of steel. Can you share some cardiovascular tips with our listeners?
No, of course. So to go over the tips, I think we have to go over kind of what to understand what these cardiovascular disease is. So essentially, it's a blockage or narrowing in your artery due to these plaques, and that causes like a mismatch from the amount of oxygen that gets applied to your tissues to the amount of demand that's required. It's like multifactorial, that causes like an inflammatory buildup. Eventually that plaque ruptures and you form this thrombus, which is a fancy term called clots, in which the clot blocks off the vessel, leading to chest pain and eventually down the line, a heart attack. But when you talk about this atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, it's an umbrella term from either a heart attack. It can occur in your brain, causing a stroke, or it can occur in the blood vessels in your arms and leg, which we call peripheral arterial disease. What we do is we take these specific risk factors and we plug it into some fancy calculator, and that's called the ACC-AHA pooled cohort equation, and that can give us an estimate within a 10-year risk of developing said events in patients at ages 40 to 75, or as a lifetime risk in patients between 21 to 39. But for everyone, we always want to stress lifestyle modification. So we want to have diets rich in both mono and polyunsaturated fats. You want to avoid saturated fats. You want low sodium diets, less than 1500 milligrams a day. And you want to be conscious with the amount of carbohydrates that we eat. So it's kind of a flip-flop from what the recommended diets were in the past, where we were saying that fat was bad. But technically speaking, nowadays we realize that more it's the carbohydrates that are bad, and you want to eat that good, the good fats. Exercise goes a long way. So it's recommended that you get at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise or 75 minutes of high intensity aerobic exercises a week. Now, things that you can take care of, and specifically for these modifiable risk factors that can decrease the risk of having atherosclerotic diseases. Some of these modifiable risk factors are: one is going to be your blood pressure, two, the amount of lipid, aka cholesterol, in your bloodstream, and then two, the regulation of your blood sugars, aka prevention of diabetes. So for your blood pressure, you want your ideal pressure to be less than 130 systolic and less than 80 diastolic. Usually we diagnose hypertension once it's above 130 over 80, or through the JNC-8 guidelines, it's 140 over 90. Usually what you want to do is once it's above 130 over 80, we stress lifestyle modifications. So decreasing, or the most important thing to reduce your blood pressure is weight loss. So every time you lose 1 kilogram of weight, your blood pressure is going to go down by 1 millimeters of mercury. Then you want to make sure you have something called the DASH diet, which is incorporating fruits, veggies, and whole grains, which that can decrease your blood pressure by an additional 10. Also, you want to stress low sodium, avoid excessive alcohol use, and exercise, so we can make sure that our blood pressure is stabilized. Next important thing we mentioned is your lipids. So how we screen for this, usually it's 2018 and 2019 ACC guidelines basically say that anyone between the ages of 21 to 75, you want to get screened every 4 to 6 years. And then you want to make sure that when you get your lipid levels tested, you want to be fasting while you take it so it doesn't obscure your results. And how you get decided for treatment. So if your LDL is greater than 190, you'll be put on something called a high intensity statin. Additionally, anybody who has a lipid level or an LDL specifically of 70 to 189, you're going to take your 10-year risk score. And if it's a high risk, you're going to be put on statins as well. And finally, anybody who has diabetes, you're going to be put on statins. But the problem is, if you're on these statins, you have to watch out for several things. One, it can cause increases in your liver enzymes as it interacts with it. So you have to make sure you have your liver functions get checked regularly. Also, you have to worry about like muscle pain and weakness due to muscle due to the enzyme that it interacts with inside your muscles. Another thing you want to talk about for statins is high intensity versus moderate intensity. That just basically means how much your LDL is going to get reduced. So your high intensity statins usually decrease it by about 50%, and your low your moderate intensity usually decreases it by about 30 to 49. Some things that are exciting, especially with these new medications, is that there's something called the bempedoic acid, aka Nexletol. It works in a similar method, two steps behind where the statins work, and they have been showing good results as well. And then lastly, for your diabetics, you want to make sure that you keep your A1C under 7%. And how are you going to do that? Usually what you're going to do is your metformin medication. That's your tried and true. That's showing increased risk or decreased risk of mortality in patients with diabetes, especially with heart disease as well. However, I think what's been very exciting is because for my time as a med student, all we had was metformin and sulfonylurea drugs. However, now that there's new medications like the GLP-1 receptor agonist, which have the added benefits of decreasing cardiovascular risks, and it adds the weight loss benefit to these patients. And then there's something called the SGLT2 inhibitors that patients can use. And those are helpful in both diabetics and for patients with heart failure.
Sultan, I think you just wrote a book. Congratulations. Yeah. That was fantastic.
Nice.
Just again, go to that website if you want to hear this a little closer, www.wwdbam.com, hit Inside Medicine, and then podcast. So, Kelly, back to you. What the heck are you? You try a lot of things out, and how do you apply that to the practice of medicine? Because you're a very diverse and, I would say, interesting doctor.
Yeah, so I've just kind of always gotten really involved in different projects. You know, you take opportunities as they present themselves. This, your show is one of those opportunities, you know. But I've gotten into some interesting spaces. I'm really passionate about global medicine, and I've done some work. You mentioned Entepesi, which is a nonprofit based in Kenya, and we do a lot of stuff there. And I'll shamelessly plug them. They're a great organization. If you're interested in that, you can go online and go to www.entepesikenya.org. That's E-N-T-E-P-E-S-I, Kenya.org. And they do, you know, kind of some of this education that Sultan's talking about, and also provide basic medical care to a lot of the Maasai people, the tribes at the foot of Kilimanjaro. I've also got the opportunity to go work at SpaceX, which you kind of mentioned earlier, and that was really incredible. I was there for about 4 months and worked with some incredible aerospace doctors who are really still involved in that space, and that's been very cool.
Yeah, so I one of the things that I noted that you talked about is the fact when you're in space, your abdominal contents kind of shift up. So I thought that would be a fantastic way for girls to lose that little pouch when they get to menopause. I know I'm not joking around a little bit, but anyway, tell me about your educational expert with these aerospace guys who are just definitely they hang out in different worlds.
Yeah, so the thing that you're talking about, you know, you're in space, you're in microgravity. And it totally changes your entire physiology and your belly. You know, I don't have the actual statistics in front of me, but you do. You lose something like 4 inches on your waist instantly because all your organs are shifting up and your thoracic cavity or your rib cage expands. So you lose weight and you buff up top, but it does make you feel like you have a sinus infection the whole time you're in space. Because there's so much extra blood in your head that would usually be in your feet. And if you look at pictures online, you can even say, like, you know, people's head shape entirely changes and they look very different, especially people who have spent extended amounts of time in space or on the ISS. You know, things like dust and sweat, which we totally take for granted here on Earth, they don't settle out. They're in the air at all times, and sweat doesn't come off your skin. It just sticks there, and it can pool in these little pools on your face and get in your vision. Dust and, you know, the flaky skin and everything is floating around, and if your ventilation system goes out, that's going to get in your eyes too. So vision's a big issue in space. For our listeners with back pain, you would think that being up there, you'd get some relief from back pain, but you still get back pain because of the opposite reason. You know, here on Earth, we have back pain from compression and the pull of gravity. And in space, you kind of have this reactionary back pain just from the stretching. You have so much less compression that you get that spine stretching, and it actually puts a lot of pain in your musculature, because those paraspinal muscles or those big backstrap muscles are overstretched and can tear. So it has some unique challenges. And, you know, the thing that impressed me the most is one of the big issues is the sun. I didn't realize, but the sun is really always trying to kill us. That radiation is a big deal. And if you are an astronaut, you're almost guaranteed to develop some sort of cancer later in life just from radiation exposure. And people who are long-term astronauts and stay on the station, they really are at risk for cancer, and there's lots of publications and documentation on that. Also, you know, the thing that people think of is there's no oxygen, and you're essentially in this giant tin can, which the sun is trying to fry and is always trying to catch on fire, and then you're pumping oxygen, which is a highly volatile gas, into that situation, and fires are a real problem. I won't go in depth into the respiratory physiology, but it does change because you're in microgravity, and anytime you're delivering artificial oxygen to a patient, I'm sure any critical care professionals that might be tuning in can appreciate that gets really complicated. So that's just kind of a bird's eye view of some of the interesting problems you have to deal with as a physician dealing with astronauts.
Yeah, I got to throw one thing in. Also, people don't understand this, but when you go into space, there's a higher propensity to become diabetic. And I do know that the sulfonylurea drugs were given to the astronauts years ago to try and counter the diabetic changes. And I haven't kept up to date with that now, see where it is. But it's like you say, you think it's easy to do that, but just think of what you're talking about. Just unbelievable. So how do they get medical care in space? Because I think you told me that one of the astronauts once became septic.
Yeah, so and this kind of applies to medicine now and today, because we've really transitioned to a lot of telehealth with modern technology and with the pandemic. And space is all telehealth, you know, unless you're up there, which generally you're not. there is actually an astronaut candidate right now, Dr. Anil Menon. He's a physician. So, you know, if he's going up there with his crew, I'm sure he'll have some role in that. But you still always want a physician that's on the ground dealing with your crew, because it is a large mental health strain being in space. So there will always be a ground doctor that's working essentially through telehealth, and you're really depending on the training of your crew to get your physical exams. And these problems that we see on Earth that maybe are easily manageable suddenly become really complicated in space. And one of the big things, you know, we talked about the diabetes thing, but kidney stones are a huge issue with a lot of missions, because they're really common in space, and they can be mission-stopping issues. When you're in microgravity, it changes your kidney filtration, you know, the blood flow through the glomerulus, and you also have this bone and mineral loss because you're not bearing weight anymore, and your body metabolizes your bones and your muscles because it's trying to conserve energy, and it doesn't think you need those parts anymore, and so you're increasing calcium and other ions in your bloodstream just from that breakdown. And between the slowed filtration and those extra ions, you have this buildup of calcium and phosphate and sodium going through your kidneys, and that's the perfect storm to create stones. So those can get infected, and that'll stop a mission. They'll bring everyone back because someone has a kidney stone. And on the Apollo missions, there was a case of urosepsis, which is just septic shock, or for our non-medical listeners, shock from an infection that's gotten in your bloodstream caused by a UTI or a urinary infection, and in this case it was from a kidney stone. So the Apollo, it's been happening since Apollo. It's a big deal, and we deal with it.
Yeah, so people have to realize what you're saying is that because there's no gravitation and you're not walking, that your bones will start to melt, and that bone, the calcium and phosphate, et cetera, then will be filtered through your kidney. And I think even the kidney filtration is affected and isn't as efficient, so you're going to end up with these deposits in your kidney, and if it gets in your ureter, there's a lot of pain there, so it's kind of hard to, you can't go to the ER up there.
No, you can't.
So let me add about this. You said that there was an astronaut who got septic, which has a 50% mortality. How do they address sepsis on a space shuttle?
Yeah, so, I mean, we send up a med kit, and one of the projects I worked on with SpaceX was the Inspiration 4 mission, which, if you follow space at all, that was a big deal. That was one of the first civilian, well, it was the first civilians to go to up and on a shuttle and orbit, and we had to weigh out everything, decide what was going to go in the med kit and weigh all those things. That was one of our roles to figure out what they were going to take with them. And luckily, one of the passengers, she was a PA or a physician assistant, so we did have someone with some medical training on board, and then we trained them beforehand. That was part of their training. But Yeah, we send up antibiotics and we tell them to take them. We also try to prevent kidney stones with potassium citrate tabs beforehand, a lot of this preventative stuff, just like you were talking about with the diabetes. And there are ultrasound trials, you know, we have these mobile ultrasound probes now that a lot of physicians are familiar with, where you can plug it into an iPad, and we train people. They can almost diagnose a stone usually with the ultrasound. And there's some trials for ultrasound therapy, you know, a different frequency of ultrasound to actually move the stone. And so if there's a kidney stone stuck in the ureter, you can use the ultrasound to move the stone back up into the kidney just to get this person through the mission. And, of course, they're going to probably pass that stone when they get back, but you can retroactively put that kidney stone back into the kidney, and hopefully it'll cause less problems there.
Wow, fantastic, fantastic. Well, let's get back to your partner. Sultan, what is Healthy People 2020?
Yeah. So this was a cool website I was able to stumble upon over the past couple of months ago through a friend's colleague. So it's a government website, basically just go on health.gov. And the main component to it is something called Healthy People 2030. And in simplistic terms, it's like it's a data-driven national objective to improve the health and well-being of the population over the next decade. So it's reflecting high priority public health issues. And it also provides evidence-based interventions for people to take a look at. So on the sites, there's objectives ranging from addiction to diabetes to osteoporosis, heart disease, as well as behavioral issues. And then, like I said, there's evidence-based resources that provides topics for anyone to read about, including both prevention, screening, and treatment as well. And then also on the website itself, there's there's a health literacy tab as well. So it provides a simplistic way for patients to kind of read up on these common conditions and how to prevent, treat, and screen and kind of manage them.
So you recommend that highly?
Yes, I do. I recommend it. Especially nowadays when people are getting their medical information from Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, I think it's a trustworthy site that the common person can take a look at and just kind of increase their knowledge.
Fantastic. Kelly, can I ask you a question? Mount Kilimanjaro, what is the nonprofit that you help make sure that it continues on? And how can people get in touch with that?
Yeah, so that's Entepesi Kenya, and that's that website that I referenced earlier, www.entepesikenya.org, which is EntepesiKenya.org. It's a really good group of people. It's a fairly new organization, only a couple years old, and it's really spearheaded by a close group of people, and they work with health officers from Kenya to go to these rural villages in the Lotokotok County, which is that county right at the foot of the mountain there. And a lot of that population is Maasai people, but, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag. And a lot of Maasai are very traditional, and they're still living in kind of what we think of as rural environments. They're building mud huts, and they live with their cattle, and they're really a farming hunter-gatherer kind of community still, and so they don't really have transportation to get to medical centers, and one of the ways that they get their medical care is by organizations like this coming to them. And sometimes when I was out there last, that means driving an hour and a half through a game preserve. You know, you're not going that far of a distance, but when you are in a bus with a bunch of medical staff and equipment, it takes a while, and you got to get out of the bus and hand put rocks in a river and cross the river, and it can get pretty wild. But you go out there and you kind of screen people, and we have Kenyan officials that come with us. So if anyone needs further medical care, they can try and get assistance through, you know, the government programs and get transportation to centers if they need surgery or anything like that. But we really do a lot of health education. We focus on women's health and giving reusable menstrual pads and teaching about the menstrual cycle. That way people can plan their pregnancies and vaccines and anti-malarial drugs and worming and this health prevention stuff that Fulton's talking about. So we'll bring some medicines and stuff, and a lot of people rely on this, and they know we're going to come through every year or so, and we're just expanding and trying to stay sustainable. So,
well, that's admirable. Fantastic. So, Sultan, got to ask you a question. You've taught these high school kids who are falling behind a little bit about science. Any recommendations you have for an individual listening to this program to enhance their medical literacy? Where should they go, maybe to figure out how's a way to maximize your doctor visit?
Now, of course, I would say it's a combination. I think in terms of being able to increase your own medical literacy, I would recommend using that website I mentioned previously. In terms of kind of besides that, the way to maximize it, I think, is making sure that you maximize and capitalize during your visit to your doctors. So what I would suggest is, one, making sure that the doctor is asking open-ended questions. That way it forces you to understand what they're talking to you about. Then there's something I would mention is the teach back method. Basically, that's something that works very well, in which, as it mentioned, you basically relay back the information that the physician has told you, and making sure that you repeat it in your own words. I think this was just kind of something that's very important that I used during medical school and even during my training. The way we learned was, if you can't relay a specific topic, you can't put it in simplistic words, that means you really don't know what you're talking about. So I think being able to bring it down to the most basic language kind of helps out as well, and also avoiding like complex medical jargon. Lastly, I would say, if you can find simple graphs or pictures, those are a lot easier to go over rather than words. I'm a big fan of pictures and graphs as well. I think those above can kind of go a long way.
Fantastic. So, Kelly, can I ask you this? You had a recent family member who got sick. How's that family member doing?
Yes, I had a dog who had a bowel obstruction which for those who don't know, she ate something she shouldn't have, and nothing was moving in her gut. And unfortunately, she had to have surgery, which we deal with people too. And she's doing a lot better. She's jumping around today and back to being a pain in the butt. But we're glad she's still with us. So.
Okay. Now, I just want to follow up. What's your experience with DEXA scans? Because you're in the gal side, and the gals seem to take a beating on their bones more so than the guys.
Yeah, so DEXA scans, you know, the recommendation, I think, through the AAFP, which is the Family Medicine Organization, which I generally go by their recommendations, they're pretty good, is every 2 years. You know, starting at an appropriate age, you want to talk to your doctor about this. The importance here really is comparison. So you don't want to sleep on getting your DEXA scans. You want to get that first one when your doctor indicates you need it, because you have to get a baseline to compare the second one to. If you sleep on this and wait on this, you have to wait till you get your second one to really get any information, because you're comparing your rate of bone loss. You're not just necessarily looking at bone density. And this is important because it's something that's really treatable, but it's something that is much more treatable on the preventative side instead of the treatment side. Once you've lost that bone, the therapies we have, you can get some of that bone back, but there's nothing like just keeping that bone. So if you have a high rate of bone loss, you really do need to stay up to date on those screenings. And if you have a family history of osteoporosis, or even if you had a family member who had a lot of broken bones, you know, granted that they're not Evel Knievel or doing something risky like that, but if you had, you know, your mom had a lot of broken bones and maybe wasn't even diagnosed with osteoporosis, you should definitely talk to your doctor and make sure you're up to date on those DEXA scans. And for those who don't know what that is, it's just an X-ray that measures your bone density. So
basically what you do is you go 2 years. Usually that's the rules of the insurers. Go 2 years and see how much bone you lose in 2 years. And if it's over 3% per year, you need intervention. And that way, as time moves on, you won't be looking at your toes as you walk. Very, very, very mm-hmm. important, and I love your explanation. Sultan, one of the things that I always see is that people have a terrible time getting how to take nitroglycerin right. Can you update us on how to take nitroglycerin and what you would take it for?
Yeah, no, of course. So as you mentioned, for chest pain, usually, especially patients who have atherosclerotic diseases, the reason you're taking this is that nitroglycerin itself is something called a vasodilator. So what it'll do is open up the blood vessels. The theory behind that is if you open up the blood vessels, more blood gets to the heart and you get more oxygen. And then that should hopefully help resolve some of that chest pain. The way you want to take it is what we call sublingual. So you want to put it underneath your tongue. The reason you want to do that is because it's rapid acting, and then there's veins underneath your tongue that can absorb that nitroglycerin so that it has a rapid onset so you can get instant relief, or hopefully get instant relief.
Fantastic. So Kelly, what about your opinion about GLP-1 drugs? You saw a lot of GLP-1 drugs use in the clinic this past few weeks. Your opinion about GLP-1 drugs, and I know you're just in your infancy of treating these kind of things.
Yeah, you'll have to fill them in. You know, you're the expert. But these medications, you know, we're talking about Ozempic, which is an injectable, Rybelsus, Trulicity, Victroza for patients that may not recognize the GLP name but are on these medications. They've been really what's the word I'm looking for here? They've changed the whole scene. They have been greatly beneficial for people with diabetes. We've never had a medicine that has made this big of an impact. And one of the biggest impacts is the weight loss. You know, these drugs are excellent for weight loss, and sometimes they're used for weight loss in people who really need some extra help and maybe don't have diabetes yet even, or right on that pre-diabetic line. But yeah, they've changed the scene, and they have some heart effects, kind of as Sultan alluded to earlier. You know, they're cardioprotective and they help stop atherosclerosis, which is the hardening of those arteries. And the way they work is by increase insulin production to kind of help you process all these sugars, but they slow gastric emptying, which makes you feel full longer and you don't want to eat as much. It kind of helps curb your appetite and you're lowering glucose production in the liver and fat storage in the liver. And there's even studies that show benefits for nerve health. So diabetics with that peripheral neuropathy or that tingling in their hands and their feet, it can help there too. So they really, it's one of our favorite drugs. I know you prescribe it all the time. It changes a lot of people's lives.
I will second that. Sultan, what about thyroid behavior when you go to a lab? What are you supposed to do with your thyroid tablet when you're going to a lab for a blood draw?
Well, I mean, I think there's the common misconception of the issue is patients will take their thyroid medication when they wake up, get up, and head to the lab and get their blood drawn. and that causes an issue because it's going to obscure your lab results. So I think what you should do is either wait until the afternoon or take your medication the night before, so that you don't get an falsely elevated thyroid level or TS abnormal thyroid level. Yeah, correct.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. So the key is if you're going to get your thyroid labs, please don't take any thyroid pill within 4 hours of that blood draw, because you have to remember that that molecule is a big molecule. So if you have a small molecule, it can get in the bloodstream, go right through the vessel walls, get inside the cell, and it doesn't interfere with your assay. But thyroid hormone, because it's a large molecule, takes 4 hours to get into the cells. So to get the best results, please don't take your thyroid pill within 4 hours. Just people get mad at you because if they don't know that, then you tell them that the result's no good, and the insurers want to charge you if you decide to go back the next day and do it right. So tough call. Kelly, let me ask you this. What would you say is the most favorite type of patient that you like to take care of?
A patient that wants me to take care of is my short answer. Yeah. I like everyone. My family, I had some real parents that had some real, they were smart people, and my dad always used to tell me, you know, you can learn something from everyone, even if it's someone that you don't like or you may think you're smarter from, you can probably learn something from them. So I pretty much like taking care of everyone, but it makes it a lot easier to do your job when you have someone who wants to be there and wants to communicate and wants to be a team player. You know, I always tell patients, they look at me and they go, well, you tell me what to do, doc. And I look at them and I go, you're the captain of the ship. I'm just the navigator. I'm just here to help people make those decisions. You know, I'm the knowledge, but patients that are really involved in their medical care and have thought about what they need, want to ask ahead of time, make my job a lot easier. So.
Okay, so you want to work as a team member, and everybody's going to work to get to the goalpost and win the game. So I like that. So Sultan, you've been a tough character. You've got a lot of experience. You're a very serious guy. Would you go to medical school again?
This is a question for the ages. I definitely do. I mean, there's days where you kind of question kind of what you're doing, but I've been fortunate kind of in between my time as an orthopedic resident and an internal medicine resident. I spent 4 months kind of being on the outside, not basically questioning myself, was this decision worth it? Kind of being back into it, I just kind of feel grateful for where I'm at. So, yeah, would I do it again? Absolutely.
I feel like it really depends on when you ask that question, doesn't it? So
yeah.
Right after medical school, maybe no, but now we're feeling a lot better about it.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so let me just move on then. I just got to ask you something. Say, because I know you're going to be a fantastic cardiologist. So what do you do if you see somebody in the office and they kind of hedge about it and say, yeah, I got some shortness of breath, doctor. And then you take a look at their legs and they have some edema. And then you ask them, do you have any shortness of breath? How do you approach that patient? Because I think that's going to be a bread and butter patient you're going to see in the future.
Yeah. No, of course. But I think the most important thing is to kind of take not focusing on the heart or lungs at that point. I think when the patient is short of breath, the thing you have to know is this patient is gasping for oxygen, and then you have to figure out kind of why he's gasping for oxygen. Is it because of something that neurologically that's causing him to not breathe in and out at a normal rate? Could it be some type of compression on the patient, or could it be a dysfunction in the organ, or is there not enough oxygen in the blood? So I think the most important thing to narrow everything down is just get the history from patients, and that'll kind of help narrow it down. Some things that you kind of want to ask the patients is kind of what causes the shortness of breath? Is it kind of when he's exerting himself? Is he moving around? Which can kind of lead to, I would think, like a heart failure type situation. Does it occur after asthma issues, where I'm thinking about like COPD or like asthma, as I mentioned. Additionally, is his position causing the issues? So if the patient's waking up at night and noticing that he's sleeping on a bunch of pillows, I'm thinking about some like heart failure. And then also if the patient has a recent illness, maybe he's anemic. So I think the workup for that is kind of getting like blood work on the patient, kind of get an x-ray to make sure that there's no fluid in his lungs, baseline EKG, make sure there's no changes. And if he has a heart history and lower leg swelling, maybe kind of get a baseline echocardiogram, which basically just shows us the actual 3D function of the heart and how it's pumping. And that can give us a clue on kind of what's going on.
Fantastic differential diagnosis. I love it. So, Kelly, how about you? What about ADHD? Are there any treatments that you've been exposed to that were beneficial?
Yeah, so, you know, even touching on what Fulton talked about earlier with depression, psychotherapy, particularly CBT, can be really useful. I myself use meditation, which is a hard thing for an ADHD person to do, but there's some great apps out there. I use the Headspace app, which they have YouTube and Netflix as well. But, you know, there's nothing quite like medication. If you're really suffering, and your symptoms are impacting your daily life, it's time to talk about medication. You know, we do have a non-stimulant option now. I know a lot of people worry about that, especially when they're treating children. But you got to bite the bullet sometimes, and you got to admit that you need help. So
good.
There's options out there. But
all right. Well, I want to thank Kelly and Sultan for coming on. Fantastic job. Next week we're going to have a orthopedic expert who talks about core strength. So we'll be back next week. Inside Medicine, don't forget to check out the podcast, www.wwdbam.com. There's 120 up there, and I'm very pleased at how well things are going. Joe Fallon, over and out. We'll be back Inside Medicine next week. Thanks again for everybody tuning in, and especially thanks to Kelly and Sultan, who are going to be fantastic practitioners. Over and out, Joe Fallon.